Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Bonsoir. Donc on va passer au séminaire. Sorry, I'll introduce you in French, and then you can speak English. Qui va être donné par Gabriel Neuror, qui vient de l'ETH à Zurich. Je vais faire très court. C'est lui qui a fait ces expériences que j'ai montrées dans le troisième cours sur les cellules qui entrent en sénescence parce que leur cytoplasme est dilué, que je trouve absolument magnifique. Il a aussi fait des travaux sur la régulation de la densité des cellules, dont certains sont un peu reliés à ce dont a parlé Morgane Delarue, et c'est ça dont il va parler aujourd'hui. Donc, merci Gabriel.
Thanks. Okay. First of all, this is working. Should I stand up here so you can see me? Thank you very much, Jean-François, for inviting me here to give a seminar at this historic venue. Actually, a friend of mine who lives in Paris told me when I told him that I'm coming here, I should definitely get a haircut and put on my best suit. But I don't own a suit, but I found a shirt, so and this will have to do. Jean-François asked me to present something that is related to the course, but it's a topic of my choice, and so it was very easy that I wanted to talk about work that we're doing on the regulation of cell density. But the issue I had was that on one hand, we have been doing work on this that has been published quite a long time ago, so people can read about this. It doesn't require a trip to Paris. But then we've also started doing some interesting work on it in my own lab. But those projects are not very advanced. But I thought maybe it would be a nice place here to actually start talking about these very early stage projects here. And so first I will talk about the role of cell senescence and cytoplasm dilution. So this is mostly published work. And then we'll talk about some very preliminary data, actually, which is mostly speculative. So I hope I won't confuse you all too much, but I think it's actually very exciting. So I think this is actually a very good entry slide. On purpose chose these colors. So one of the key observations that has really inspired a lot of the work that we're doing in the lab is that cell size is strictly controlled. And as you have just heard for the last 2 hours, there has been a lot of work to understand how cells regulate this very basic property. One question that has received a little less attention over the course of the years is, why is this important? So why do cells care that they have a specific size? And so this is a question that I have focused on during my postdoc in my own lab. And the reason why we think this is an interesting question is because whenever cells change their size, this is, for example, the case during differentiation. So in multicellular organisms, cells can come in sizes that span different several orders of magnitudes. And so whenever cells change their size, this goes along with a change in cell function. And so one example is differentiation, but these size changes can also occur during pathological conditions, such as during cell senescence, where cells can grow several times larger than their normal size. And so senescence is actually an important process in which cells permanently lose their capacity to divide, and they start secreting inflammatory cytokines. So these senescent cells actually accumulate in old tissues where they interfere with tissue function. And so we were very interested in the role of increased cell size in senescence, and this is what I'm going to talk about first is work of Sandhya Manohar, who's a postdoc in my lab. So the reason why senescent cells are very big is because their cell cycle is actually blocked. But because cell cycle progression and biomass accumulation are only coupled loosely to each other, when cell cycle progression is stopped, cells will continue to increase in size. Yeah? Now, during cell senescence, this cell cycle block is usually caused by external stresses or internal stresses. These can be damage to the DNA, telomere erosion, oxidative stress, also during chemotherapy. These types of damage are induced, and they usually cause a block at the G1 to S transition, which usually goes through one of these pathways here. So these are just cell cycle regulators, basically. Now, what's interesting about senescence is that cells that have become senescent, they cannot reverse. So they cannot go back and restart proliferation. And this is really important because if you do chemotherapy, for example, you don't want cells to restart dividing after the therapy is over, right? And so one thing that we hypothesized was that maybe this large increase in size could contribute somehow to this loss of fitness in oversized cells. And so to test this, we used a drug that can block cell cyclin-dependent kinases, so they can block cell cycle progression, but this drug is actually washable, so you can add it, cells stop dividing, and you can remove it, and cells will continue to divide. And so if you leave this drug on for quite some time, cells will actually grow very large. But we can also restrict cell growth during this time. And this can be done, for example, by inhibiting growth pathways or by growing cells confluent so they are contact inhibited. And so when you do this, cells will stay small. And now you can compare kind of what's the effect of this continued growth and not of the cell cycle arrest. Okay. And so the kind of surprising finding that now many groups have done is that when you let cells grow large during these long cell cycle arrests, they lose their proliferative capacity almost completely, okay? So when you plate these large cells at individual cells densities and then you see outgrowth of colonies, you see only a few colonies forming, but if cells are kept small during these long arrests, then they can resume proliferation and form many colonies. And so, we thought that this might actually be quite important because these types of drugs that prevent cell cycle progression are in fact used quite frequently in chemotherapies. And so if you think about cancer cells in a tissue, many cancer cells actually have overcome this kind of contact inhibition which prevents cells from growing. But cancer cells will actually still grow, and so if you prevent cells from dividing, it might be just the cancer cells that continue growing that become big, while cells in the surrounding tissue that are contact inhibited have actually turned off growth regulatory pathways. So that's kind of the condition I showed you before, where cells are contact inhibited and they maintain their functionality. And so we think that this finding, this growth-induced senescence, might actually play an important role during these types of processes, and that's something that we're looking at right now. Because of this, we were quite interested in finding out why these large cells cannot divide anymore. And so we've done quite some work in describing the defects that these large cells encounter. And so this is just a short summary of these defects. So when we release these large or small cells from a G1 block, many of these cells will actually enter one cell division. During this division, the large cells will encounter some kind of replication stress. So these are this is an assay where we can measure the progression of the replication fork. This is actually done in collaboration with the lab of Rob de Bruin. And so large cells actually have somewhat slower replication forks. And importantly, large cells, when they enter G2, they actually accumulate a lot of damaged DNA. So this is a COMET assay where we use electrophoresis to visualize fragmented DNA. And you see here, nuclei from large cells contain a lot of this fragmented DNA after they have gone through S phase. So large cells have problem in S phase, they accumulate DNA damage, but despite of this, actually many of these cells will enter mitosis. And if you enter mitosis in the presence of damaged DNA, it's not a good thing to do, because instead of having two nuclei, in the end you can end up with many, many different nuclei. So the nuclei of these cells fragment, okay? And so once these cells have undergone a mitosis that results in an unstable genome like this, they will permanently arrest and they will never go back into the cell division. And so we also identified one molecular mechanism that might underlie some of these behaviors. So Sandia found that a protein called 53BP1, which is an important protein in the repair of DNA double-stranded breaks, this protein fails to go to double-stranded breaks in large cells. So in small cells, every double-stranded break here, which is marked with a histone mark, gamma JUX, is usually followed by the recruitment of 53BP1. Now, the consequence of this is that if you have a double-strand break, you actually fail to repair it. So in G1 phase especially, cells need 53BP1 to repair double-stranded breaks. But also 53BP1 is necessary to signal the presence of a damage, of a DNA damage point to the cell cycle machinery. And so in combination, these defects lead to accumulation of DNA damage during S phase. Actually, we think that the reason why they accumulate so much DNA damage is not necessarily the replication stress, but their inability to repair the damage. But then, despite of having a lot of damage, they do not signal this to the cell cycle machinery, and so they enter mitosis and permanently arrest. So this work has been published. This is the first paper from our lab, but what we still don't understand what is really the underlying problem here. And so we didn't actually start with work in mammalian cells. Actually, I'm a big fan of another model system, budding yeast S. cerevisiae, and we can actually do the same trick as we did in the mammalian cells. So you have cycling cells. We can block cells from dividing. Here we can use conditional alleles of cycling-dependent kinases, and then we can follow cells as they grow very large.
So when you stop them from dividing, do they still produce proteins or not?
Yes, exactly. So they accumulate biomass. Well, the answer is... for some time, they will. Yes, so until here, they do. Okay, but that's probably one of the problems. So you can also reduce cell growth, and here we use cyclohexamide, or we can reduce growth by using low levels of glucose. Cyclohexamide is an inhibitor of protein translation. Actually, it turns out that the different ways we reduce cell growth have actually different effects. But when we do this, we can also again analyze what are the defects that these really oversized cells have. And in fact, we can see some of the very same defects. So these large cells have problems in S phase. They accumulate damage in S phase. They have very long and error-prone divisions. But they also have other problems with nuclear function, such, for example, a regulation of transcription. And we know that they also have problems with signaling with detecting external signals and signaling them through MAP kinase signaling. So really, here we have, I think, a much more complete picture of a set of cellular functions that break down. So, and these are unrelated cellular functions, so suggesting that there's really a fundamental problem inside of these cells that leads to kind of a global breakdown of cellular functions. So what could this be? So one of the things that is pretty easy to test in these budding yeast cells is the contribution of DNA. So remember, we were arresting these cells in the G1 phase of the cell cycle. That means they continue to accumulate proteins without actually making more DNA. And so as these cells grow larger, the DNA to cytoplasm decreases. The DNA to cytoplasm ratio decreases. And when we analyzed at which size these haploid or diploid cells, so these are cells that contain two copies of the genome, at which size they get problems, we could see that haploid cells get problems much earlier than diploid cells. So that experiment showed that really the limiting factor in these very big cells is actually how much DNA they have. And so DNA is required to make RNA, and RNA is needed to make proteins. And so what we looked at next was at the RNA and protein content. And this is where we made actually a discovery that was quite surprising to us for the following reason. So when cells grow larger, they actually at some point attenuate protein and RNA synthesis. So for some reason, they cannot produce more RNA and protein. We think that this is because they run out of DNA template, that somehow the DNA becomes limiting for RNA production. What was surprising, however, was that the cell volume continued to increase. And so what this experiment showed really was that cell volume increase and macromolecule production are not actually the same thing, which was completely contrary to my understanding of cell growth. And when I listened to the few things I understood before about cell size regulation, I think you mostly talked about cell volume. But this experiment actually really pointed out that it's important what entity you measure, right? Cell size is actually not clearly defined. And in fact, when people were measuring whether growth is exponential or linear, I think some of these measurements that gave contradictory results were because some people were measuring volume while other people were measuring mass. mass, not mass. So this type of cytoplasm dilution that we called it is actually also occurring in the senescent cells I've shown you before. So this is not a direct measurement of protein concentration, but this is using this genetically encoded nanoparticles that Morgan Delarue was also using. I believe he also talked here some time ago. And what you can see here are diffusion rates of these large particles inside of cycling cells or inside of senescent cells. And so if these particles move faster, it's an indication that the cytoplasm is somehow less crowded. And you can see the senescent cells have many more particles that move fast, and so that they're color-coded green than the cycling cells. Now, actually, such changes in overall protein and macromolecule concentrations don't only occur in these senescent cells, but they're also observed during differentiation or if you measure in different cell types. So this here are actually measurements by Sun Jin Oh when she was still in Mark Kirschner's lab, where she was using normalized Raman imaging to measure protein concentration inside of cells in actual tissues or in cell lines. And as you can see, the overall protein concentration in these different cell lines actually varies quite a bit, and by a factor of two. And also, if you look inside of a single organ, you can have quite a big variability in the overall protein concentration. So why do I think this is remarkable and we should talk about it? Well, the reason for this is that the space that's usually depicted as empty in cells, the cytoplasm, is actually not empty at all, but it's tightly packed with macromolecules. In fact, about 20 to 40% of the cytoplasmic volume are occupied by macromolecules. If you look at the concentration, it can be up to 250 milligrams per milliliter. That's actually really, really high. So the solubility of BSA, which is a well-soluble protein in water, is about 40 milligrams per milliliter. So the cytoplasm can somehow tolerate a much higher concentration of macromolecules. I think one really striking observation that illustrates how packed the cytoplasm is that if you compress it mechanically by only 30%, and this leads to a complete gridlock of movement inside of the cytoplasm. So I think cells really live at this critical point where only small changes can actually have dramatic effects. And so the reason why I think this is a really key feature of the cytoplasm is because changes in this overall crowding, as we call it, will actually affect many physical behavior of proteins, such as how they diffuse, but also how the conformation that proteins can adopt, and also how proteins interact with each other. And so we thought that maybe these changes in crowding could actually be the underlying problem for many of these defects that we observe in the very big cells. This is kind of something that we hypothesize, but it's really difficult to actually test because how can we alter this property? And in order to find ways to alter it, we kind of need to understand how this basic entity is regulated. And so we thought a good starting point for this might be to simply understand how protein production and cell volume growth can be uncoupled from each other. And so if you look at the composition of a cell, it's roughly composed, its dry mass is roughly composed of 30% dry mass and 70% water. And so if you want to increase your volume without increasing your dry mass, what you have to do is increase the water content. The way to do this is by increasing the amount of osmolytes. So really, the volume of a cell is mostly regulated by the amount of osmolytes. So when we analyzed these growth curves in these long G1 arrests a little closer, we actually noticed an interesting transition that occurs just at the point where RNA and protein synthesis become uncoupled from volume increase. Okay? And this happened around 2-3 hours after cells were in these long G1 arrests. And what you can see here is that cell growth changes from what looks like an exponential curve into a perfectly linear curve. And so over here you have the growth versus the the cell volume, and you see in the first time growth is exponential, and then it switches to a linear curve. Now, when we compare these types of growth curves between haploid and diploid cells, we can actually see that diploid cells will also reach a linear growth, but the linear growth is twice as fast as the linear growth in haploid cells. But at the time when cells switched to linear growth, they were already growing twice as fast, and they're also twice as big. So we thought that maybe this initial size when this switch happens is kind of defining how quickly you continue to grow. Good. And then, yes. And so one way we thought maybe we could test this, so we were trying different different drugs and, you know, to interfere with this, to kind of prevent this volume increase. We were really not very successful with that. But one result that was interesting was when we treated cells with rapamycin, which is a drug that inhibits TOR complex 1. So TOR complex 1 is a main regulator of protein synthesis. It regulates the generation of ribosomes, but also translation rates. So when we inhibit TOR complex 1, cells immediately stop accumulating proteins, and they immediately switch to a linear growth regime. And if you compare this growth regime, this linear growth regime, to what happens when you don't treat cells with rapamycin, you see that this is also, again, a slower growth rate. Okay, and so the only thing we really found that was able to prevent cell volume increase was if we completely removed the glucose from the medium, which could mean two things. Either cells require energy, or they require the glucose to make metabolites, because glucose is also a precursor for metabolism. And so kind of the dummy model that we put together, and that's why I was also a little bit intimidated before coming here, because I feel like a field worker and coming here to people that know much more about math than me. But so kind of what we thought could be happening is that as long as cells are producing proteins, they're metabolizing glucose, they're taking all these small metabolites, incorporating them into proteins. But if they stop making proteins, they might still take up glucose, they metabolize them, but then these metabolites fly around inside of the cells, and this could kind of drive this increase in volume. But of course, the question was, what are these relevant osmolytes? We still don't actually perfectly know. And why does the rate of volume increase depend on how big the cells were? And so this is where I was very happy last year to learn about the Rolland model, which is, I don't know how many of you know Romain Rolland, who's working with Jean-François and Pierre Sans. He made, I think, or they made two important, they recognized two important things here. The first one was that they actually measured the contribution to overall cell volume or osmotic potential of a cell of the different cellular components. So over here you see the contribution of the different cellular components to dry mass. But if you consider that all of these molecules are actually osmotically active individual molecules, and then you calculate the contribution to cell volume, you can see that proteins actually only contribute very little to overall cell volume, but most of the cell volume is regulated through osmolytes, mainly metabolites, amino acids and sugars, and also through their counter ions. So if you regulate the production of osmolytes, you actually get kind of 2 points out for each osmolyte, one for the metabolite and one for the counter ion. And so together, metabolites and counter ions make up almost 80% of the osmotic activity of this is data from mammalian cells. Now, the other thing that they realized in this model was that, of course, if you want to make osmolytes, you need enzymes. And so the rate at which you generate these osmolytes should actually be proportional to the amount of protein you have inside of a cell. And so the bigger cells are, the more proteins they have, and so the faster they will accumulate osmolytes. And so this explains why, for example, if you treat cells with rapamycin, you stop making more proteins, you just keep growing at the rate that you're already growing. And so Romain put all of this into a quantitative pump leak model that, now I've got to be careful, that takes into account all the basically osmotic equilibria. I was really amazed by how well this model actually fit with the data that we had previously obtained. And so I think we understand pretty well now how cell volume and protein increase can become uncoupled from each other in the absence, notably, of any osmotic perturbations. And so that can happen because the rate of protein synthesis can become uncoupled from the metabolic activity of a cell, and so from the accumulation of osmolytes. Now that we understand how these two processes can become uncoupled, of course, the big question is, how do cells prevent this from happening? Because as we saw before, it might be beneficial if cells maintain their crowding at a certain level. And so in the second part, I want to talk about our efforts of how we are trying to identify potential crowding sensors inside of cells. And this is where it's starting to get very speculative. Okay, I hope you will enjoy it. So before I start talking about what we did, I just want to point you to a problem, which is that most of the things we know about the homeostasis of osmolytes, we know from measurements in the context of osmotic perturbations. Okay. And so what happens if you, for example, put cells in a hypotonic solution is they rapidly take up water, they swell up, and this leads to kind of a tension at the membrane, and then cells release osmolytes, organic and ions, and that leads to a recovery of the cell volume, and they go back to their initial volume. Now, most of the sensors that have been identified in these types of responses actually respond to increased tension here at the plasma membrane. This is true, or decreased tension at the plasma membrane also in the case of hypertonic shocks. Okay, so one famous example are these mechanosensitive ion channels, which open up when you have too much tension, right? Now, what we just learned before was that actually proteins contribute very little to the overall osmotic pressure of a cell. So these type of osmosensing mechanisms are, in my view, actually a pretty poor sensor for the overall protein concentration inside of a cell. And so we thought maybe there are other ways cells have to measure their overall macromolecule concentration inside of the cytoplasm. And so the first question is obviously, do cells even measure this? Is there evidence that cells are able to regulate macromolecular crowding? And I think, you know, apart from the fact that we found that protein concentration decreases when cells grow too large and DNA becomes limiting, there are actually also a number of studies, I think, that suggest that crowding is under homeostatic regulation. And one of these observations is if you really precisely measure the density of cells, actually the variation is really tiny. It's actually smaller, about 100 times, the CV is about 100 times smaller than the variation in cell size. If you perturb cell density naturally, for example, when cells go into mitosis, they swell up, the density decreases, but then they go back to the initial density. And we also know that after osmotic perturbation, cells rapidly return to their initial density. From Morgan Delarue's lab, we know that proteins stop being produced when the pressure increases too much. And there's also very nice data from James Farrell's lab, and there's a preprint that shows that if you take Xenopus egg extract and you vary its concentration, that the protein synthesis and protein degradation rates also are dependent on its concentration. So there's, I think, quite a bit of evidence that suggests that cell density is under homeostatic control. And so how could this work? Well, we know that the two ways how we can alter the density is either by modulating the rate of protein synthesis or by directly modulating osmolytes, so either synthesis or transport of osmolytes. And so if we think about homeostatic control, we think that maybe in cells that are not dense enough, that are too diluted, they could boost protein synthesis and block osmolyte accumulation and vice versa. And so if we're looking for crowding sensors, we might look for proteins that change their activity based on the crowding, and then they could influence one of these processes, osmolyte homeostasis or protein synthesis. And so Guido Narduzzi, who's a very talented PhD student in my lab, has taken on the the task to use proteomics to identify such crowding-sensitive proteins. And so the goal of his project was to, on one hand, identify proteins that could act as crowding regulators and modulate crowding, but at the same time, we were hoping that maybe we can also see proteins that are involved in some of these processes that we know are failing in senescent cells. And so maybe we could kind of get a better understanding of how crowding influences these processes. And so what were we looking in terms of crowding-sensitive processes? So macromolecular crowding has actually been studied quite extensively, and there are some processes that we know are crowding-sensitive. One of them I already mentioned is protein conformation. So in crowded environments, proteins prefer to take on a more compact conformation. And so we thought maybe we could use proteomics to kind of detect such conformation changes. And then also crowding favors kind of a more compact conformations also if we think about multiple proteins. So crowding really favors low affinity interactions. And one special case of this are these biomolecular condensates, which can actually bring proteins close together. And so in collaboration with the lab of Paola Picotti and her senior scientist Ludovic Gillet, we have been using proteomic tools that they have developed to kind of look at these processes. And so the system we're using to modulate crowding are actually concentrated yeast extracts. And so the advantage of this is over frogs is that we can actually combine this later with genetics. And so what we do is we grow yeast in media, we filter away all the media, and then we freeze them and we grind them up, and then we spin down the debris, and we're left with basically what we think is mostly undiluted extract. Yeast cells also have a vacuole, so that kind of dilutes the extract a little bit, but we're somewhere on the range of 0.5 to 0.8x concentrated extract. We're working on methods to also concentrate the extracts in vivo. Now, to alter crowding, we're using different methods. Today, I'm only going to talk about one way how you can influence crowding, and that is by using synthetic polymers. So synthetic polymers can actually be added to biological systems. Actually, they're added to a lot of in vitro reactions to make them work, so crowding is important. And so we use at the moment polyethylene glycol, PEG, and we use it at different concentrations. And so one of the first things we noticed that when we add a little bit of PEG to these extracts is that we get some kind of a bulk phase separation behavior. And so in order to do our first experiment, we separated those two phases, and we're working with the dilute phase, with the more dilute phase. But at this concentration of PEG, we still have 90% of the initial protein concentration there. Okay, so the first experiment that we did is called limited proteolysis mass spectrometry, or a short LIP. And the way this method works is that you take a native extract, so proteins are in their native conformation, and then you use an unspecific protease, such as proteinase K. You digest for a very short time, so you don't digest everything, you just digest the most accessible part of proteins, and then you denature and you fully digest and you end up with these peptides. Now, if you have a second condition where you have crowders, you can imagine that some of these sites might not be accessible to the protease anymore, so you don't digest them, and then in the end, you can detect peptides that are only detected in this condition and not in this condition. Okay, and so with this proteomic method, you can kind of detect quantitative changes in conformation of proteins. So this can be done on a proteome-wide scale, and so this has all been mostly done by Ludovic. And so what you can see here are individual peptides that change their abundance in dependence on whether or not there is PEG present in the cytoplasm. And then here you can see that the p-values. And so this peptide here, for example, is a peptide that is more abundant in the presence of PEG, meaning that it was protected here from the proteinase K. Okay. And so now we are actually quite excited because we first you know, we have proteins that change in relation to crowding. And so what I'm going to do now is just go through a couple of these examples and say why I'm excited about them. Okay, but we have no evidence that they're important. So one of the interesting ones was, for example, is glutamine synthase. We're excited about that one because glutamine synthase is actually catalyzing the conversion of glutamate to glutamine using ammonium. And as we learned before, glutamine is actually one of the main, glutamate and glutamine are the main osmotic amino acids. And so these are actually at the core of this density regulation probably. And so it's really interesting that we find crowding dependent changes in this protein. We haven't followed this up any further. Another metabolic enzyme that we found is phosphofructokinase. Phosphofructokinase is catalyzing the second step in glycolysis. And the reason why this is actually a quite important bottleneck is because if you don't have phosphofructokinase, you're actually redirecting the glycolysis into storage carbohydrates. And so we can actually simulate this by using inhibition of protein kinase A. So and when you do this, you can actually you redirect the glycolytic flux. When you measure dry mass density in yeast cells after inhibition of proteinase kinase C, A, we can see that we get almost a 50% increase of overall dry mass density in these cells. And so I think these experiments really indicate that apart from this regulation of protein synthesis, actually direct regulation of the metabolism at the level of metabolic enzymes might be really important in the regulation of this crowding in the cytoplasm. Okay, that's what I just said. So the second kind of observation and information that we got for free when we did this experiment is that when we added this PEG, we got all these little condensates, and condensates are an interesting topic these days. And we figured that, you know, we could also just look at what proteins are specifically prone to enter into this condensates when we add crowder. So are there proteins that phase separate in a crowding specific way? And so for this, we took different concentrations of PEG, separated the dense and the dilute fraction, and then submitted this to mass spectrometry. And so this is kind of the bulk protein phase separation that we get. This is where we did the lipid mass analysis before, so where we get almost no of this bulk phase separation, but if you increase, you rapidly get to 50% and so on. Now, if you look at individual proteins, we actually see that we have quite some variability. There are some proteins that were already more than 50% go into the separated into the solid phase, just if you have very little PEG, so if you increase crowding a little bit, and then some proteins really seem to resist going into this dense phase. So when you analyze this area under the curve here, you can see that there's kind of a bimodal distribution. And so we're kind of looking now at the protein features that make them go on this side or on this side. So far, I think one of the features that really popped up is actually the size of the protein. So I think smaller proteins prefer to be over here, and then larger proteins rather go into the separated phase. Now, apart from maybe learning things about, you know, what protein features make them crowding sensitive and make them go into this dense phase, we could also look again at individual proteins and see if the data that we're getting out of this makes any sense. And so we looked at a couple of things, and one of the things we looked at are components of P-bodies. So P-bodies are the condensates, liquid condensates that form in response to various stresses, and they contain inactive polysomes, ribosomes, etc. And so all of the components of the P-bodies that we found in our data set actually preferentially phase separated when we increase crowding, which was quite good to see that, you know, something that you will kind of expect is actually behaving in that way. What we didn't expect was that when we looked at this TOR complex one, so this main regulator of protein synthesis and also crowding, TOR complex one itself behaved extremely sensitive to crowding, so at the second concentration we already couldn't detect TOR complex one anymore in the dilute phase. And so the exception for this is a protein called TACO89. This is a protein that is actually not quite clear yet what it's doing. Some people say it's part of the TOR complex 1, some people say it's not. It's probably associated with one form of active TOR complex 1. Apart from this, all other members of the TOR complex are behaving in such a crowding sensitive way. And as I said, TOR complex 1 is a main regulator of cytoplasmic crowding, right? And it leads to this uncoupling of volume increase and protein production. And so what we think might be happening is that if cell density is too high, TOR complex 1 might become inactive due to this increased crowding, where it could inhibit protein synthesis and leads to a reduction in crowding again, and vice versa. And so before I finish, Federico, a postdoc in the lab, started looking at this behavior a little bit in cells. And so what he did is he used hypertonic shocks to shrink cells. And so this is what you see here. And when you do this and you look at one of these P-body components that I talked about before, you can see that these components rapidly form these little foci here, which we think are some of these condensates that are induced by increased crowding. Now, when he looks at these different members of the TOR complex 1, he can also see, I hope you can appreciate, that you rapidly get these foci that were not present before the hyperosmotic shock. So this is a quantification of this data that's really showing that most cells will have a focus after you compress them, and also the number of foci increases after osmotic compression. And so this is kind of a working model we have right now, how TORC1 might be sensing and regulating macromolecular crowding through phase separation. So if crowding is high, TORC1 becomes inactive, leading to reduction, and vice versa. So of course, these are all correlations, and they're just, you know, speculations. Obviously, it will be good to now do genetics with these informations. And I think one intriguing possibility is that TORC1 phase separation is induced through prion domains that have actually been known to be present in a protein called COG1. So COG1 is raptor in mammalian TORC1. And so an interesting experiment would, for example, be to now find mutants in TORC1 that cannot phase separate, and see whether now we can perturb such homeostatic behavior. And with this, I'm at the end. I just briefly recap. So in the beginning, I've shown you that excessive cell growth is detrimental for cell function, that this uncoupling of cell volume increase and protein production can be explained by an uncoupling of protein production from osmolite accumulation and metabolic activity. Then I've shown you that TORC1 is prone to phase separation, and so it might act as homeostatic sensor to regulate crowding. And then I also showed you some data that metabolic enzymes might directly be under crowding control, and so it could at this level also influence the crowding control. Okay. And with this, I want to say thank you for your attention. I want to say thank you to the people in the lab who did the work. So Sandia did the senescence work. Marina, Guido, and Federico are the crowding team. And then the lab of Paolo Picotti was very instrumental in the proteomics. We just recently started collaborating with Mathieu Piel. So Federico got a postdoc fellowship together with Mathieu Piel. And then in the old paper, Liam Holt was in his lab. They were doing the measurements with the CHEM. So we didn't do those ourselves. We got some strains from Robbie Levitt. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.